from Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
The people of Illinois are taxed out. A $1 billion income tax cut should be our number one objective by the end of this session.
I mentioned to him this morning that he had been going around saying he was against last year's tax increase, and yet he's spending all of it in this budget. He's not talking about getting rid of it at all.
My name is Elena Hampton. I've spent my career knocking on thousands of doors and organizing for several elected officials while working for the Speaker of the House, Mike Madigan, and the Democratic Party of Illinois. During my time of employment with the Democratic Party in 2016 and 2017, my supervisor was harassing me for a span of 5 months. Accepting that they weren't going to protect me and that I was going to lose everything I worked for because a man could not control himself was devastating. I never wanted to do this, but I know that my silence only protects the perpetrator in the organization, which will allow the situation to happen to someone else.
I received a letter in my home from Ms. Hampton. I turned it over to Heather, and within days she opened an investigation at my request and met with Ms. Hampton and proceeded with her investigation.
All I can say is that I'm very sorry that Ms. Hampton wasn't satisfied, and I still stand by my belief that it took a lot of courage for her to come forward, and I appreciate that she brought this to our attention.
Another allegation of sexual harassment, this time on the political side. We'll talk about why this latest situation putting more scrutiny on Speaker Michael Madigan. And also Governor Bruce Rauner delivering a budget plan he says would save the state money. We'll talk about the details and more coming up on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler. He's director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. And in our Statehouse studio, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio Statehouse reporter, and Doug Finke. He covers the Statehouse for Gatehouse Media. And Doug, thanks for being with us once again.
Good to be here.
Let's get right to it. Doug and Brian, you both watched the governor make his deliver his budget address, and tell us what basically the governor had to say. What was his theme for this address?
The theme to me was let somebody else pay for stuff because he listed a bunch of things that he wants to accomplish that would essentially shove costs onto other people. Downstate teacher pension costs, he wants to start moving them to local school districts. He wants to cut the amount of money that the state pays for state employee health insurance, for example. He wants the employees to pay more. We're going to have to see how this plays out because those are tough issues to expect the legislature to go along with. But he is depending on some big savings from being able to accomplish those two things.
And Brian, your thoughts as well?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that jumped out at me most is that after he's been campaigning on this tax increase is terrible, last summer he said it was a 2x4 in the head to the people of Illinois, and then his budget, as we heard from Senate President Cullerton mention, spends the entire tax increase. And we can talk a little bit later about, you know, his what he calls a path to reducing taxes. I think that deserves its own treatment, but I was just struck by the fact that after saying that, you know, Illinois doesn't need this money, we need to live within our means, there were very little in the way of, you know, deep cuts in government, and he plans to spend all that extra money from the tax increase he says Illinois shouldn't have passed.
This is the fourth budget address the governor's given. Charlie, you had a chance to analyze this one, and what have you seen?
Well, I agree with what's been said so far. This is, on the governor's part, for once he's not relying on what Comptroller Mendoza referred to as pixie dust and magic beans. There's no multi-billion dollar line in there that says the grand bargain, or nothing in there that says, I forget the terminology of the budget before last year's, but it was along the lines of giving me the power to cut everything unilaterally. Instead, he makes the spending that he's asking for fit within the revenue that's likely to be there by shifting close to $1 billion onto local school districts and universities. Now, for the universities, he says you have to pick up Ultimately, universities, you should pay all of the ongoing costs of your faculty and staff pensions. All the benefits that they earn in a given year, you're responsible for funding those. And to make it easier, we'll spread that over 4 years. This year, we'll make you pay for the pensions, and we'll have you pay the health care costs for your employees, and we'll give you money to offset that. Now, the local school district, he says the same thing, but there's no offsetting money. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the dollars that are involved and compare that to the increase he's asking in general state aid to be allocated under this new formula, it's quite conceivable that some school districts would wind up with less money were this to happen. And the governor says, well, you got to make them accountable. They spend this money, they don't have to pay for it. That's not really true. The reason I say that is the terms of the retirement are set by the state legislature and the governor by statute. The biggest cost driver in the pension cost is the 3% annual increase that was enacted a couple decades ago. Local school districts have no option over that. Local school districts don't get to say what percentage of your final salary is going to count towards your pension per year. All that stuff is set in law. A local school district can decide not to give pay raises, not to hire teachers, but to say that it's their fault, I think that's dishonest.
Well, Doug, go ahead, Brian.
I was going to say, we even heard this argument, though, from House Speaker Michael Madigan in the past about this idea of, you know, giving them skin in the game and, you know, they're getting a free lunch, I think was the phrase that the speaker used when he had an albeit much more gradual cost shift to local
districts. Yeah, it was over 16 years.
Right. I don't remember the exact timeline, but it was quite different from this proposal, we should emphasize. But what he would say is that, you know, it's the salaries are going higher, I think. You know, so you have some school districts where you could be making more than $100,000 a year as a teacher. Now, we can have a debate about whether that's good policy and some teachers are underpaid, no doubt. But, you know, I think that's where he's, you know, they can set, as you said, Charlie, they don't get to set the terms, but they do get to set the salary, and that salary determines the pension amount. One other thing I think the governor would say is that is integral to his idea of shifting these costs onto local school districts is giving them what he calls flexibility in contracting and, you know, over their employment relationships. And what that's a sort of a covert way of saying, do the things that I want to do to unions that I've talked about and the Democrats have rejected all this time, such as, you know, taking health care, make that something that they can't bargain over. Perhaps if he had his way, he's even complained in the past about the fact that unions representing public employees can bargain over wages. And he cites the federal model. It says, you know, that should be like that, where they can't even bargain over wages or health care or benefits or anything. And just work rules is all they should be able to bargain over.
So, Doug, after all of this, is there seem to be any type of support down there for at least talking about this idea, maybe something in some fashion that could work?
You mean about shifting the pension costs
right
on the schools?
Mm-hmm.
At least yesterday, the reaction that we were getting from various lawmakers, including lawmakers of both parties, was not very positive. Most of them that mentioned the fact that this would likely trigger property tax increases, which is something that the governor, even in the state of the state message, said that we need some property tax relief. We got to address that issue. But then we turn around and he proposes this that a lot of people think would force up local property taxes. So there's I'm sure it'll be discussed to some point. This idea was actually endorsed by House Speaker Michael Madigan at one point. Whether he's in the mood to give the governor a victory on this during an election year is another issue. But, at least right now, it doesn't sound like there's widespread support for this.
You know, and Doug, that's interesting. You talk about people complaining about this leading to a property tax increase. And I think that this is just another example. I mentioned the tax increase, how the governor is going around complaining about the tax increase, and yet he spends it. He says property taxes are the worst thing when he's on the campaign trail, and then he comes and makes this proposal that a lot of lawmakers see is going to lead to a property tax increase. And it just makes you scratch your head about that disconnect. And, you know, I also I can't help but think that this is taking the strategy really that played out in the last few years in state government, where there was this squeeze put, right? The tax rate had gone down in the beginning of 2015, and yet spending continued unabated during the budget impasse because so much of the budget is really what we would call non-discretionary, right? It's kind of automatic, paying bondholders, paying pension, courts ordering state employees to be paid, Medicaid payments. And it squeezes state government, and it creates this crisis atmosphere. And by forcing these pension costs onto local governments and universities, you begin to create that squeeze on the local government level too, which just makes people angrier and, you know, is either going to eventually force higher tax rates down the line or some sort of, you know, wholesale change of our understanding of contract law and the Constitution and changing pension benefits and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he has tied this to the idea of these so-called reforms or flexibility to local governments. And that, again, goes back to this idea of restricting collective bargaining rights, which has been part of his mantra since he took office. So if you start squeezing the people who have to provide for this extra pension cost, then that builds up pressure to give them the so-called flexibility, and that plays into his agenda.
Well, and I do want to point out that everybody on the panel, except for Doug, does have or is in the university retirement system for the state. But Charlie, something I wanted to ask on this would be, does he have a point when he talks about the amount of money that is going into the pension systems and that is making it harder for the state to invest in other priorities? And he raised that issue during the address. He's raised it before. Is that a legitimate point?
It is, in the sense that I forget the exact percentage, but it's well over half of the pension payment does not go to pay the costs, for example, that all of us on the panel but Doug will incur for the benefits that we will earn for working this budget year for the university. It goes instead to make up for money that hasn't been put in, I guess, for the last century. There is documentation that suggests 100 years ago, the legislature was warning the governor that we're not setting aside enough money to cover the future costs of the pensions. And that's been ongoing. And so it's this liability, and the liability can't be touched by changes in the law that affect people who are in the system now. That's what the Supreme Court said a couple years ago, when the General Assembly and Governor Quinn attempted to reduce benefits. Court said you can't do that unilaterally. Now, the model that is being proposed and that Rauner suggested might save $1 billion would give public employees a choice between staying with what they have now but not counting any future pay raises towards their pension, or giving up the automatic increase in benefit every year in return for factoring in the future pay raises. But the constitutional question is that a valid choice? Either way, you wind up with diminished benefits. And so is the court going to say, well, yeah, it's you can either drive off the cliff or run into the burning building. It's your choice. Or is the court going to say the only way it's valid is if there's a third option? You can keep exactly what you have now. And I would guess that most people would opt to keep exactly what they have now, and so it wouldn't save that much money.
And for what it's worth, the unions have raised exactly the point you just mentioned, that the so-called choice is not a choice at all, and so therefore you're inevitably looking at a court challenge if they ever do manage to pass this thing.
Yeah, and another thing to keep in mind, everybody focuses on the unions, but the constitutional guarantee doesn't say for people who belong to unions, it says for anybody who's a member of the retirement system. So what that means is someone who's not a union member, who's in the system, could challenge any attempt to diminish benefits that the legislature passes and the governor signs.
And Brian,
they could do that, but I mean, the unions would have the financial resources, obviously, to pursue that.
What I'm saying is you can't say, well, the unions agreed to it, so therefore it's kosher. That's not going to work. Because I'm sure that it would be other people who would be willing to fund that kind of a challenge brought by an individual. sort of like the way Rauner found somebody to attack the fair share agreements.
And Brian, this was not an idea that just came out of nowhere for the governor either. This is something that, again, Democrats have talked about in the past.
You're talking about this consideration model.
Yes.
Yeah, this originated with Senate President John Cullerton and his legal team. And they would point out, you know, there's been the pension, so-called pension reform that was attempted several years ago that the Illinois Supreme Court later found unconstitutional. One of the big proponents of that was a then state representative named Daniel Biss, who's now a state senator and now is one of the leading candidates for governor, or at least for the Democratic primary nomination for governor. And so we're hearing a lot about that plan, and, you know, Biss is being accused of having voted for an unconstitutional plan. What Senate Democrats would say is that they actually preferred the consideration model then and were actually working with unions on it. But, you know, now that the unions have won their subsequent court victory at the Illinois Supreme Court, I don't think they're going to come on board with this anyway. I would like to get back, though, Sean, to something you were asking about a couple minutes ago about this, not spending on other priorities because so much money is going into the pensions. This is something I think the budget wonks call it crowding out. And that is something that I heard then-State Representative Elaine Nekritz, who, when she was pushing this pension changes several years ago, talked about that. And I think that this is something that Governor Rauner thought he had an opening with sort of liberal what you might call bleeding heart liberal Democrats who care about early childhood education. And he had said, you know, years ago, before he was even a candidate for governor, we hope, you know, I think we can talk to Democrats and get them to make a choice. You know, we only have so much money. Do you want to put it into, what he then called AFSCME, his sort of derogatory term for AFSCME, the union, or do you want to put it into these social justice programs of state government? Of course, it didn't really play out that way because there's been just basically a partisan war for the last couple of years. But there are people on the liberal side of the equation who would probably deep down agree with him about this crowding out issue and spending these money on benefits, you know, what other people call a generational transfer, right? So, you know, not only for the last century did people not pay enough taxes in Illinois to meet these obligations, but now we're asking this next generation coming up to pay more, and then that money gets transferred up in the form of these guaranteed contractual pension benefits that people have earned.
Oh, and I would note that one of the arguments that Representative Nekritz and then Representative Biss and other supporters of the plan that was signed by Pat Quinn and others was that the state was in an emergency situation. The state needed to use its police powers to override the guarantee in the Constitution, basically to have money available to fund all these other programs. And the Supreme Court, in a very formal way, laughed in their face, saying, "You're coming in and you're pleading we don't have enough money, and you let the tax increase expire and passed up billions and billions of dollars. Give us a break."
One last thing I want to mention on the budget is, you know, the governor, we mentioned earlier how the governor is going around talking about the need to lower taxes. He told the Sangamon County Republicans at their Lincoln Day dinner last week how he was going to try to get it back down to 3% in 2 years. But there is no evidence of that in his actual budget proposal. What he does call for is using this consideration model of, you know, changing pensions, as we had talked about, and, you know, quite responsibly, he actually says, if that is realized, if the savings from that are realized, which would, you know, take not only passing the bill, but the court challenge we discussed, if that is realized, then we could do a quarter of a percent. That's 25 cents out of $100 in taxes decrease, taking the current rate from 4.95 to 3.7 to 4.7%. And, you know, the governor is fond of saying that the tax increase last summer was a 33% tax increase. Well, this would be a much smaller 5% tax decrease.
But let me mention another thing that might be problematic. The governor's budget proposal also wants to reduce Medicaid rates across the board by 4% to save $150 million. The problem there is that we're already in a stressful situation. Hospitals are worried about having enough money to care for patients. There have been instances in the past when low rates to providers have caused sort of medical care deserts, particularly in rural areas, where practitioners have stopped seeing Medicaid patients because the rates were so low. So if I'm a rural legislator representing a rural district, I have to be concerned, if the rates go down for Medicaid care, will there still be adequate care available to folks in my rural district who are on the Medicaid rolls to help pay their health costs?
I will be watching the budget and the fallout from the speech and whatever else reaction to it as we go along over the next several months as they try to come up with a budget plan for the next fiscal year. But I do want to save some time on the show today to talk about another issue that cropped up this week, and it involved the Speaker of the House, Michael Madigan, issuing a statement that a staffer of his had been fired. Brian, give us sort of the background. What was going on here? Who was this person? What was this all about?
Yeah, this it's a woman named Elena Hampton. She's in her 20s. She says she spent most of her 20s working for political organizations run by House Speaker Michael Madigan. He has a number of them. Friends of Michael J. Madigan is his main campaign operation, but he also controls others, Democratic Majority and the Democratic Party of Illinois. And she says she would, you know, as work as an organizer, was door knocking. At one point in 2016, her supervisor, and there's a lot of names here, there's many characters in this story, so bear with me. But she is working directly for a guy named Kevin Quinn, who is harassing her. He is sending her text messages again and again, just asking her out, complimenting her. And, you know, at least in the images of these messages that the Chicago Tribune posted this week, she appears to just sort of politely but firmly say, "I'm not interested. I'd like to keep our working relationship professional." And he just persists. At some point, she makes what she says is a very difficult decision, and goes to this boss, Kevin Quinn's brother, who happens to be Chicago Alderman Marty Quinn, who is House Speaker Madigan's right-hand man in his ward political organization, and complains. The Alderman Quinn tells his brother, knock it off. He says that she only wanted this, she wanted this handled discreetly and quietly, but since then she decided that because the brother Quinn was still in the organization, he hadn't been fired, she had to leave, and then she was worried about this damaging her job prospects, and so she wrote a letter to House Speaker Madigan at his personal residence to make sure he'd get it. He immediately hands it over to his lawyer, and she conducts an investigation, which Elena Hampton says takes too long. And eventually she goes to the Chicago Tribune. As she is being interviewed and the Tribune is preparing their story, the speaker announces that, you know what, we are going to fire this guy, Kevin Quinn. And so Elena Hampton goes to the Tribune. I feel like this story could go on forever. There's a lot of twists and turns. So, suddenly the bottom line here is that the hashtag MeToo movement is now landing on the doorstep of House Speaker Michael Madigan. And I thought Mark Brown, the Sun Times columnist, had, an interesting way of Madigan is used to dealing with political opponents and of both parties. And this is something that is a force even more powerful than he is that's kind of sweeping him along at this point.
Well, and certainly we saw the speaker, I guess you could say he got out in front of the Tribune with this week. He ended up having a news conference. What did he have to say about this? Doug, you were there.
Well, he had precious little to say himself. He deferred most of the answers when people ask questions, he deferred to his attorney to answer most of them. They've insisted that they handled this correctly. His attorney said that the reason it took so long for this to be resolved is because she had to give it, investigated it. You didn't just rush to judgment on these things. And that was her explanation anyway. And, the speaker largely sat there in silence as she was explaining all this.
And one of the things that Elena Hampton complains about, and she actually in her news conference, one thing I didn't mention here is that she has filed an Equal Opportunity Employment Commission complaint against one or two of these campaign organizations. And one of the things she directly addressed, Heather Weyer-Vaught, who is one of House Speaker Madigan's attorneys, and said, I trusted you and you ran out the clock here, knowing probably, and I didn't know, what the statute of limitations was on a sexual harassment complaint. She's accusing them of deliberately running out the clock. They say they needed to do a thorough investigation, but it just so happens that that took so long that it makes it a lot harder to seek legal justice in this case.
So what happens next? Is there some type of further investigation happening at the state level? Is the inspector general involved? Do we know?
Well, no, the inspector general can't be involved because she was not a state employee. Although Kevin Quinn, the person who is, she says was and has visual images showing these harassing text messages, he was one of these people who would sometimes be on the state payroll, sometimes be on the speaker's political payroll. For these interactions, he was the political payroll. And so this is not a matter for the state inspector general, but there is this Equal Opportunity Employment Commission complaint, and there will something be more with that. The other thing that could happen, though, is she made reference to, I'm not alone. I know of other women who have had experiences like this where instead of handling it in a public way, it was, the priority was put on kind of keeping it quiet and sweeping it under the rug. I think you can't help but notice the timing here. And we didn't, again, this is a very complicated story. I didn't mention that. But she first made this complaint to the alderman, the perpetrator's brother. I think it was in March. It was early in 2017. And, that was before the Harvey Weinstein allegations. That was before this big sort of raising of consciousness in American society about sexual harassment. And, since then, after that had kind of become something that everybody was talking about, it was in the news, that's when she wrote her letter to the speaker. So that, the dynamic now has changed. And just, the speaker, if it comes out publicly that there are more examples like this and that they were not handled in a way, the way you handled something like this in 2016 might not look very good from the perspective of how we think these things should be handled in 2018. Our perspective on this is changing fast.
Well, you did hear from some people who, admittedly, people who have been on the opposite side of Michael Madigan, coming out saying that he at least should step aside or he should possibly step down, not only as speaker, but as the state Democratic Party chair. Doug, does that seem to be gaining any traction?
No, not at this point. I don't think anyway. To a certain degree, you would expect from some of these people that's what they would say. The speaker should resign. There have been calls for his resignation for other things, in the sense that his departure because he's been there too long, and people think it's time for a change, but. After the initial flurry of this, the speaker said that I'm not going to resign, period. So he is at least hunkering down for the time being and I guess waiting to see if this kind of dissipates.
All right. Well, that will wrap up this week's program. Members of our broadcast today included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Doug Finke. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and also find us at NPR One. The production assistance for the program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.